Do you have any financial regrets? Most of us do. And if you don't, what's your secret? Bankrate.com's new report shows that our financial regrets go beyond the usual credit card hangover. Techonomics host Jason Middleton has that and a little more.
Hello there, and thanks for listening, as always. When the email hit my inbox, I knew I'd have to not only talk with our friends over at Bankrate.com, but I'd have to pull a Sinatra tune. I mean, the story is about financial regrets.
Regrets, I've had a few, but then again.
Nearly 3 in 4 U.S. adults have financial regrets. That's according to the new report from Bankrate. The most common is not saving for retirement early enough, followed by not saving enough for emergency expenses, and, of course, taking on too much credit card debt. Student loans are up there, too. I spoke with Bankrate's Mark Hamrick about his regrets. Then we got into some other economic areas, some quasi-political areas as well, none of which I regret talking about. Here's our chat. It seems like everybody's regret really just comes down to planning.
Well, first of all, I just think it's significant that about 3 out of every 4 Americans do have financial regrets. It makes you wonder about what about the rest of them, whether they're either just very pleased with the way things have proceeded or they just aren't dialed in. But when you look at the regrets that Americans have, the majority of those regrets are all connected with a failure to save. And at the top of the list is the failure to save for retirement earlier. I talk about this with young people, the fact that they have the advantage of time on their side, even though they might be worried about a potential downturn in the stock market. My gracious, if you're 25 or 35 years old, you've basically got, you know, decades and decades before you're going to be even thinking about touching that money. So there are going to be market cycles. The market's going to go up and down. For others, you know, I would advise looking at a budget. I think a lot of people spend money that they don't realize they're actually spending. If they saw a dollar sign connected to the amounts that they're spending on certain things, they might think about pulling back on that. But the other part is, and we don't want to be brutal about all this, is that one of the things that has occurred as a result of the financial crisis and Great Recession, and even in the midst of the recovery, which has now proceeded for 8 years, wage growth generally has been lackluster. And so that has caused tension for budgets, and things like the cost of a college education or health care, those things have gotten significantly more expensive. So there are real points of tension around the everyday lives of Americans and their money.
When you mentioned the wage growth, it reminds me that you and I have been speaking about this same thing for years, for 3 years at least, 3 or 4 years. This has been almost a lead almost on everything that we get back, right? I mean, okay, inflation's a little bit down. Well, so are wages. Well, inflation's a little bit up, but wages are still down. There's no slack in the labor market anymore, but the wages are still down. When's it going to break?
Well, I don't know that it will, first of all. I mean, you know, just because you wait for the bus forever doesn't mean the bus is actually going to come. Every economist on the face of the planet would say that at this point in the cycle, with unemployment at a level that's considered to be close to so-called full employment, that wage growth should be occurring at a significantly more rapid pace, but it's not. So then we have to ask ourselves some questions. Well, how might this time be different? Is it different? And among the things that are different is certainly that some people get sick of hearing it, but this financial crisis was really unlike any other since the Great Depression. The recovery out of it occurs in the midst of globalization. And of course, technological change mitigates in many cases the need for workers. So I also think that with the number of people who are in the workforce being at a relatively low level, meaning people who are working or looking for work, it may actually be that there is more slack in the workforce than is commonly believed. And if we can keep the recovery going for a while yet, and obviously nobody knows the answer to that, it'll be interesting to see whether we might actually get the unemployment rate as measured by the government below 4%. It has happened before in our history, and if so, then that suggests that there is more, let's say, water to be wrung out of the washcloth with respect to capacity in the workforce, but there's no guarantee there.
I do agree with you that automation and technology is also helping dampen things, because it's hard to justify that without something in place like a payroll tax. With every robot that replaces as a human, I think there should be a tax on that. But I'm not going to ask you to comment on that because that's
no. I'm happy to comment on that. Bill Gates put that idea out there. You know, the idea that if you're going to invest in a certain kind of technology, which could have the impact of diminishing the need for human capacity or human workers, human resource, perhaps you should pay a penalty for that. I'm not sure the economics of that works out just yet, because right now we have a problem with businesses in a way failing to invest in their own enterprises sufficiently, and that's often blamed for, at least in part, for better productivity. But I think the conversation is worth having, and I think these conversations, if anything, are going to pick up speed over time, because this technological pace of change is not going to slow down based on everything we know right now. It's a conversation we need to have, absolutely.
And just a little bit of a tangent here, but there's something you touched on that's very vital, and that is that CapEx was supposed to go up this year, according to a really good survey out in January, right after the election, and that's when the market started to boom with the Trump bounce, right? But that doesn't seem to be coming to fruition right now.
Well, a lot of things aren't coming to fruition as envisioned, including the execution of many of the president's proposals. In other words, things aren't working out quite as perhaps the administration envisioned, and it remains to be seen whether such efforts, including tax reform, infrastructure funding, actually are put in place. And the political reality is every day that the president's approval ratings drop further, and we do see that dynamic presenting itself, leaving aside the question of which tribe politically one might be situated in, if one is in one or the other, that makes it less and less likely that the president has the political capital left to push these things through. Republicans in the Congress are more and more attempting to distance themselves from him and the administration. And so the much hoped for economic lift from the president's election has yet to be seen. We may get a recovery here, or I should say a bounce in the second quarter, but a sustained bounce along the lines of his much vaunted 3% or better GDP, not so much. This is not to be cheering for or against the president, but to talk about the economic realities that are attached to the political process. And right now that process seems to be spinning its tires.
You know, Mark, I always say if you want four opinions, ask two economists. But if when it comes to the Trump budget proposal, his growth expectations coming out of the White House at 3.5 to 4% are pure fantasy. And you can ask any economist, I think, on either side of the aisle when it comes to that.
Well, and I would say watch this space, because at Bankrate, we conduct a quarterly economist survey. It's just wrapped up, and we did put that question to the economists. So I don't want to steal my own thunder on that. But I think, you know, if you look at the coverage that is out there with respect to the proposed spending plan that the administration has put forth, it's being savaged for that very reason. There's basically a $2 trillion difference based on the economic expectations that the or assumptions that the budget is based upon. And that's a pretty big margin of error. You know, I posed the question via Twitter recently, is like, what happens if a private business that has a publicly traded stock made a economic or business prediction that was off by that level of magnitude? Mm-hmm. So, and this really isn't even a political question. I mean, the people on both sides of the political aisle, if even they're on one or the other, agree that the 3% GDP prediction is just not based on reality, based on everything we know. We wish it were different, but wishes don't make it so.
Well, you can't hear me, but I'm nodding vociferously in agreement with you, Mark. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for so much time this morning.
No, it's always great to connect, Jason. I hope you're well, and I appreciate you having me on.
That's Mark Hamrick, senior analyst at Bankrate.com. For links to this and all of our segments, check out KGORadio.com/Techonomics. We also have a link to Mark's recent research there. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Well, as soon as I rant about something near and dear to me and hopefully most of us, the internet. Think of it as the central nervous system of not only our economy, but the entire 21st century. Net neutrality is the policy that keeps the internet free and open. The new chair of the FCC, Ajit Pai, wants to change that and tip the web in the favor of massive corporations. Corporations like Comcast. Comcast has sent a cease and desist letter to an advocacy group that promotes a free internet. the internet as it exists right now, by the way. It's called Fight for the Future. Evan Greer, Fight for the Future's campaign director, said that the cease and desist order is indicative of why net neutrality is needed. Quote, if Ajit Pai's plan is enacted, there would be nothing preventing Comcast from simply blocking sites like ComcastroTurf.com that are critical of their corporate policies. End quote. Now, the only beneficiaries of revoking net neutrality protections are ISPs, giant corporations, and the politicians who serve them. Check out Facebook.com/Techonomics Radio for more links about this. It's a hobby of mine to agitate Ajit Pai and his indefensible position against net neutrality. For producer Liana Wilcox and executive producer Mike Anthony, my name is Jason Middleton. This has been Techonomics. Have great weeks, everybody.